It's time for the Canadian Baseball Network Podcast with your host, Dustin Saraceni.
Welcome back to the place where Canadians come to feast on baseball content, where we put the red and white first and gather the greatest minds around the game the country has to offer. Today is another special podcast with another incredible guest in Philadelphia Philly scout Alex Augustino. Alex, thanks again for coming on.
No problem. I appreciate it.
Of course. So I kind of want to get into the life, what life is like as a scout, how you even got into the racket coming from Quebec. But before all that, this isn't the first time you've been recognized for your handiwork. And I'm talking about, obviously, the New York Hot Stove Association Scout of the Year Award. In 2006, you won the Canadian Baseball Network Scout of the Year. You're number 61 in Bob Elliott's Most Influential Canadians in Baseball list. But when it comes to the Hot Stove Association, how did you first find out about the honor, and what were your initial thoughts? Did you expect something like this?
Well, first of all, it wasn't really expected, except that I knew that I was in nomination
right.
A couple of months ago, where the part of that New York Hot Stove Association, where myself, Eric Valent, an ex-big leaguer with the Mets and Phillies, and Keith Conley, a cross-checker with the Kansas City Royals, were nominated. And those two guys are really good guys, good friends of mine, good scouts. And, I thought for sure that them being in the area, one playing with the Mets, one growing up in Jersey, and myself, that one of those two guys would win. But after their December meeting, I got a call from the president of their association, Billy Blitzer, who's a longtime scout with the Chicago Cubs, to tell me that I had won the vote on a very, very tight vote that I'd in the 2018 Scout of the Year, which to me was very, how would I put it, it was very humbling coming from Montreal, growing up in my baseball, my roots are in Quebec and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to say the least, but very honored.
Now you'll be honored at the 54th annual banquet in New York, January 25th, Bobby Valentine coming in as the guest speaker. Which is something I'm sure you're looking forward to considering, man, as you look back, like Gil Hodges have won the award.
Oh, it's definitely going to be a great night. My wife and my kids are going to come down. We're going to make it a nice little event. Spending some time in New York. I've been to that event more than once. There's always great speakers. Bobby Valentine is somebody who I've met a few times. Different occasions. Last time I sat and watched a game with him a little bit. He's the athletic director at Sacred Heart University. So he just comes and watches games and loves to talk baseball with the different scouts that are out there. So he's going to be entertaining. Just to look at the names, the first winner in 1966, I think, was Gil Hodges.
Yeah.
Who was a Mets icon. And to be part of that, I'm very proud to be part of that list. The thing that's the most fun for me is that, there's not any other guys born in Montreal who grew up in Quebec that have ever won that award. And the fact that I'm working in the area, working for the Phillies, and that we've done a good job in the last few years in that area, it's fun to be recognized, but it's a whole team effort also.
Yeah, and we talk about your awards, obviously, we talk about your accolades, where it all kind of started. All of this kind of started in St. Bruno, Quebec. I mean, a place where you're a tremendous and influential figure. Can you kind of take us back to your time there? When did you kind of come to realize that you wanted to do what you're doing, and who introduced you to the game, first of all?
Well, first of all, you never dream of becoming a scout when you're a 7-8-year-old kid starting Little League Baseball in St. Bruno. In those days, you wanted to play for the Montreal Expos, and basically I grew up, it was easy, it was very simple. It was my father who was the most influential person who loved the game. He was an Italian immigrant who came over in the 50s and grew up near Jerry Park and just, fell in love with the Montreal Royals and Jackie Robinson when, they were playing back then. I guess, my dad came in late 40s, early 50s, just watching baseball. He loved it, going to the Expo games and just brought the game to me and my brothers. But growing up in St. Bruno was easy. It was very bilingual. We had an army base in St. Hubert. Everybody played hockey and baseball, and some soccer. So in the summer times, you played baseball, you had a lot of fun. There was not a lot of pressure. You just played and enjoyed it. You're always at the park. In the winter, you played hockey. And then, you just kept doing it. So I was lucky. I had good coaches, fun time, playing in a simple era, not what we call travel ball, just going out there and having fun. But I guess it was my 4 years playing junior for the St. Hubert Diplomats in the Quebec Major Junior League, that got me to a point where, this is really fun, and probably not good enough to play for the Expos, and that dream's going to go away, but I'd love to coach and stay in the game. And, you know, I had some good coaches. One was Matty Alston, who's a Quebec Baseball Hall of Famer who played in the minors with the Phillies. And he got to coach me in St. Hubert. And then Tony Taylor, an ex-big leaguer, who was married at the time to his wife in Brossard, Quebec. Well, I sat with him in the bus a lot. We just talked baseball all the time.
Mm-hmm.
While I was doing my studies in at the University of Montreal in physical education. So same thing in those ages. You know, you played baseball junior and you played some hockey. I like competing at both of them. I love both sports. I coached at both of them. And all of a sudden, just, you know, there's a bit of timing that's involved where you're starting to work. I was working in a hockey complex basically after my college time and running one of the first hockey complexes in Quebec that had four rinks. They kept glass in Brossard, so I was running hockey schools, you know, doing the Vladislav Tretiak goalie camps, international camps. I mean, working summer, what we call those fantasy camps, you know, Bobby Hall, Gordie Howe down there, our owner Leo Borgo knew all these people. So I was basically, again, the wintertime working in this hockey rink and running these camps, and summertime coaching some baseball with my buddies, and it just all came to a head in 1990 when I was just gotten newly married and a couple of opportunities to go play some hockey in Europe. One of my professors at university had the chance to be a player coach out in France or take the job at Baseball Quebec as the technical director and a coach at the Academy of Baseball Canada. And I decided on the sun instead of the cold in Europe. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, so you're basically a good Canadian kid, as John Cherry would say, hockey in the winter, baseball in the summer, and it all kind of accumulated to where you are now?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was fun. You know, I still love both sports, but at one point, you know, when you're 25 years old and you have some opportunities, and for a family lifestyle, you're like, you know what, this could be a different opportunity in terms of, you know, Baseball Quebec, where I was given an opportunity to be the technical director and run the coaching and the mm-hmm. elite team programs, the Major AAA, but it timing's everything. The Academy of Baseball Canada had just started in the fall, and I was brought in at around Christmas time. And then you get to work, you know, with the Eric Gagnés of the world, the Stubby Claps was in at the ABC as a player. We had some good big leaguers that had gone through there, even, you know, Steve Green, Eric Sear, Pete LaForest, and I'm surely forgetting a few, like Maxime St-Pierre. It's just that, you know, you get to coach. Now you're in baseball full time. This is not a volunteer job anymore. It's not just, you know, this, you're able to live your passion. And as the more you do it, the more you love it. And again, you're working closely with the Montreal Expos because every fall I was able to get to, you know, Expos Instruction Weekend, throw some BP, hit some ground balls, learn from the coaches that were there. And as our offices at Baseball Quebec were at Olympic Stadium, you got to see multiple games. You got to, you just to be around guys. Go watch Denis Boucher pitch to Joe Siddall in a game at Olympic Stadium with Larry Walker playing at first base. And you're dreaming, like, yeah, you want to be on the field, but you also know that that's not where your future is going to lie. But your future could lie where you can coach, you can teach. And after 5 years with Baseball Quebec, again, opportunity comes knocking. It's 1994, there's a strike. Baseball Canada has a technical director job open, interview for the position in Chicago at an ABCA convention at the same time. Montreal Expos receive a phone call. You want to meet Kevin Malone. They have a scout opening in Canada. So you put on hold the Baseball Canada thing, and you're like, okay, let me meet with Kevin Malone. This could be a dream come true. And days later, you're hired in 1995, and during the strike at the end of January to represent the Expos as their scout across Canada. You know, that was the start of year number one of year number 25 that's coming up in 2019.
Wow, I mean, like you said, you grow up wanting to be on the Expos. I know you had success as a pitcher, as you said, assistant coach with Quebec, Quebec's technical director, pitching coach with the 1994 Canadian team. And I guess, like you said, it's all about being at the right place at the right time. It's all about timing. That's kind of how you kind of parlayed all of that into a scouting career, as you said, one that started with the Expos and then to the Florida Marlins ultimately, right?
Yeah, well, timing and a bit of luck and having people like Claude Raymond, who ex-Expo big leaguer, my mentor, and basically the reason I got an opportunity with the Expos, me and Claude did the Petro-Canada play ball clinics. It was my first job with Baseball Quebec in the summer. Was basically getting to do 40 clinics in about 45 days that Petro-Canada and Labatt sponsored with the big van, and go around Quebec and the Maritimes with a special man in Claude Drimont, where you do camps all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about Claude Drimont from my father and all that when he played in Villeray, and now you get to work with him, and he treats you with such respect, and he loved the way I taught and my passion. And he talked to Bill Stolman and said, hey, if we have an opening, there's a guy who's, you know, bilingual and he speaks a bit of Italian and can teach and could represent us. And then it's, you know, the timing factor comes in where you have to make those decisions. And, you know, after coaching the national team in 94 with John Haar as the head coach, I was the third base coach. Harold Nordcott from Alberta was the pitching coach. We had a blast out there. What a team we had. And
mm-hmm.
Ryan Dempster, Eric Gagne, you know, Kevin Nicholson at shortstop, was a first rounder with the Padres a few years later. One of the most epic games I've been involved in, where we lost to Team USA, and Eric Valente, who's a scout now that was a finalist for this award, beat us on a walk-off in the 12th inning in front of like 4,000 people in Brandon, Manitoba. And, you know, that was the end of the summer, and boy, what am I going to do? Am I going to take the, am I going to move on to Baseball Canada? Or all of a sudden, you know, out of the blue, you get a call from the Expos, and you just keep building, because that's baseball. You start at the bottom, you know, and in my case, it was coaching with the Longueuil Dukes in the Montreal Junior League, and then, you know, working with the Quebec Elite teams, and then the Academy of Baseball Canada. And then you just get to meet tremendous people.
Mm-hmm.
You get to move around a lot, and you get, you know, you get to show what you know. Since you're not an ex-professional player, you have to bring something to the table. In my case, I think it was, you know, knowing how to teach, knowing how to communicate, knowing how to treat people,
mm-hmm.
and also knowing how to evaluate. And because in 1991, is a little-known fact, but the Tom Volk, who was the head of the Canadian Scouting Bureau, hired me to do Quebec part-time. That was for 1 year. When I started with Baseball Quebec as a technical director, he wanted someone who was in the loop. And we did a few camps, and I got to do a couple of scout schools, you know, where you learn about the scouting, the grading system, and all the little, you know, writing reports, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
And just watching a player saying, yeah, he's good and he's not. And that was fun, too, just reading. And I love to resource myself and read.
Yeah.
And my first year with the Expos, I was also able to go to the MLB Scout School, which was in Lakeland that year. And that was, you know, tremendous help for me, where you're hanging around with the ex-big leaguers, ex-minor leaguers, college graduates, and you're learning how to scout, how to organize your area. And after that, well, you got to do it yourself, because you have to have a lot of discipline, because you're most of the time basically on your own and go get him. But over 25 years, I mean, it's changed tremendously, where, you know, no computer, no phone the first years, to computer, phones, analytics, and big, big changes. But I've been lucky to work with good people in Montreal mm-hmm. and Florida. The years in Florida were, you know, they were a little different, because, you know, I moved on with my boss and the same staff from Montreal who went to the Marlins, and we won the World Series in 03, but it wasn't as enjoyable, because now you're covering Canada, but you're working for the Florida Marlins, and, you know, you got to be honest, they really didn't care about Canada unless it was like a first rounder or something. And when
yeah.
the first rounder, you got all 30 teams on them. So the 4 years there were fine because of the World Series win, but the rest wasn't really as pleasant as my years with the Expos.
Right. Well, it sounds like you've had an absolutely incredible journey, and you talk a little bit about what you bring to the table, and I want to get into further how you evaluate, but I kind of want to backtrack with your time with the Expos. I mean, you did choose Pete LaForest in the 16th round, who ultimately signed with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, Sean Hill in the 6th round of the 2000 draft, Eric Sear, and most notably, Russell Martin. I mean, in the 35th round, Martin, as most of us know, didn't sign with the Expos and was drafted by the Dodgers in 2002. But those are four players who kind of made it to the major leagues in four seasons under your watch. Looking back, what did you kind of see in this crop, in these crop of players?
Well, growing up in the grassroots level, growing up, you know, always being around younger players, and my years of Baseball Quebec working at the Academy, I just think I had a little bit of a knack with younger players and projecting, finding out the guys who had the tools. We start with the first guy, Pete LaForest. I mean, we worked him out at Olympic Stadium. He was 16 and a half years old a couple of months before the draft, and Kevin Malone, our GM, is hitting him ground balls, tobacco in one cheek, and, you know, he's in his three-piece suit, and he's hitting ground balls, and Pete's throwing and doing everything, taking BP, hitting balls, you know, off the wall, and stuff like that. He's just, a guy like him is like, you could he could hit. He would always barrel the ball, and he was strong, and he had the good attitude. Now, mm-hmm. we draft him, and we signed him for $5,000, peanuts.
Wow.
Kid wanted to be an Expo. He's down in Lantana. You know, he's getting pro ball involved, and, you know, a month and a half later, the Expos decide to void his contract because he had a sore back. I mean, what a start to my career. You're like, him crying on the phone, me wanting to quit.
Yeah.
What am I doing this for? Why are we not treating a local kid better than that? You know, and he goes on and has a 16-year professional career, time with the Rays, time with the Padres, and ironically finishing his career while I'm a Philly, he also finishes his career in the big leagues with the Phillies, you know, had a couple of months up there. And you're like, why did this happen? You know, why did the Montreal Expos, doctors in Florida, have no clue that we signed a 17-year-old kid for $5,000 and, you know, not bear with him? And he goes back to college for a junior college for a year and gets a better deal with Tampa, I think, who gave him like $40,000 back then, which was pretty good.
A little bit of an upgrade, yeah.
And he ended up being a big leaguer, and I was, you know, tremendously happy, one, for the kid, who is still, you know, one of my most favorite people in this game.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Eric Sear. You know, it was a question, we drafted him late. He was a 6'3 lefty who threw 81 to 85 miles an hour, but he was 6'4, lanky. I thought he was going to throw hard one day. And back then, we had those draft and follows. We let him go to college, and we just didn't have a visa to sign him. So what does Eric go and do? He goes, and, you know, he gets married to a girlfriend down there in Oklahoma, and San Diego signs him the year after, and he gets his cup of coffee in the big leagues, and he made it up there. It took a while, but then you got, you know, Russell and Sean Hill in the same draft. I mean, that was a tremendous draft for the Expos. We drafted Cliff Lee, Grady Sizemore, if I'm not mistaken, that same year. You get Sean Hill,
wow.
If it wasn't for injuries, probably would have had a, you know, 15-year major league career. He had like a 15-year pro career and close to 5 years of service time. I mean, just a tremendous individual. I know he's a pro scout with the Yankees now. And Russell, well, you know, I love the kid. I loved him from day one. He played like a professional when he was young, and he had the tools. You could see he could run. He had quick feet. He had a good arm. He had soft hands, and he barreled every ball. He didn't swing and miss. The power wasn't there at that time because the size wasn't there. But he goes off to college, and our scouts down there just basically thought he was just a good little college player. So, you know, I knew the kid from when he was 15 years old in our leagues. And, again, at the Montreal Expos, the bosses were not, you know, people from Montreal, or they really didn't care necessarily, you know, where the players came from. And it's easy to bury a player when he's 17. Russell was 17 when he was playing down in junior college, because in Quebec you graduate that year younger. And, yes, he did struggle statistically his first year. And, you know, I just think that, you know, Montreal Expos team, you got a kid who's born and raised in Canada, played his baseball in Montreal, you know, a hop, skip, and a throw from Olympic Stadium, would have loved to play, and, you know, you let him go on, and you look at the career he's had, and nobody's perfect in scouting. You know, that, even my bosses back then were like, wow, we really missed on that one. And, you know, it's like, hey, it's part of the game.
Right.
It's just I wish that the Expos would have had a little bit of the attitude the Blue Jays had when Anthopoulos was there, where give that opportunity to the Canadian player or the local kid, not necessarily, you know, give him a job if he's not good enough. But if we're equal, why not give a chance to those kids? Because some of them flourish, and Russell's makeup is what made him have the career he's had, which is, you know, pretty much a tremendous career in professional baseball. But those players there were on a small area, made the job fun, because you have a small area. There's a lot of teams fighting for those guys, and if you could see something in the future and those guys do become, as those four guys became big leaguers, it's like, yeah, you did your job.
Yeah, and we talk about Russell Martin, obviously, as a 15-year-old. How important is being a high character away from the field and on the field? Is that almost just as important as his talent level? I mean, with your experience as a coach and scout, what kind of is the difference between grassroots scouting as in a kid trying to enter college and professional as a college player trying to make it to the next level?
Well, the first thing for sure is always the talent. You're always looking for tools, you know?
Yeah.
You're looking for speed, you're looking for arm, you're looking for bat, barrel control, barrel, all that is great. You have to have the talent to play at the next level. But the character, the makeup off the field is what makes you become who you can become. Because if you don't have that, you will not become, you won't, the projection that we see. So the character doesn't mean, you know, the guy who's, you know, always in bed at 9 o'clock at night, who is always, you know, yes sir, no sir. It's the character, the competitiveness of the player. Like a Russell Martin was very competitive, mm-hmm. always wanted to be the best on the field, would outwork everybody. We watch him at the ABC, watch him at the Canadian junior national team, you're always aware that this kid loves to be on the field, and that the game is so tough. I think that the character of the player, his competitiveness are two things that, as a scout, it's tough to maybe see right off the bat. But the more you watch a player play, the more you get to know him in your area and talk to coaches, that has to be something that you have to tack on to the tools, because there's been tons
right.
of players who have some tools, but either they're not the hard worker, or either when it comes to a competitive nature, they're not as competitive, or they, you know, sometimes they don't have their better performances when it's tighter. And that, you know, as you move up the ladder towards the big leagues, it only gets harder. It doesn't get easier. And again, you know, that's something that's really, really important to me, the makeup of the player, because makeup's
right.
a lot of things. You know, he works hard. You know, is he a character player? Is he a competitive player? But once you get to know the makeup of the player, you know, that's where Scott, I think, can really make his name, where these are the type of players that you want in your team. And just a quick anecdote, I mean, we've got, from my area right now in our Philly system, I think there's six players that are in the system that I signed, and at a meeting in October during our instructional league camp, I'm walking around, and one of the guys works, you know, in the clubhouse. When a guy takes care of everything, the equipment, everything, the guy was out there first in the morning and late at night. He just came up to say, "I just want to let you know, Alex, your guy." I go, "What? Did they do anything wrong?" He goes, "No, we don't have to chaperone them. You know, they're always on time. They're
nice.
Polite. They're hard workers. They're hard nosed. They compete. They're a delight to be around." You know, and then it's like, wow, that's a good thing to hear from your own team, because those guys are, those people who work in the clubhouses, they're every day with these players. And, you know, when you have to babysit a player because he's not on time for practice, or you have to babysit him at the hotel, or even in his locker room, if his locker is all dirty, little things like that, where you've got to know the player. Is he going to be able to be in a professional level where it's not mom and dad that are picking up his room, that bring in the Gatorade? You're now a professional. So those are other things that you have to take into consideration to make sure, do you think this player will become who you think he will become? It's not just his physical tools all the time, even though that's the number one thing you're looking at as a scout, is the physical tools.
Obviously, you have Ben Peleche in the system.
With the Class A Williamsport Crosscutters, he had a solid season, hitting 277, 9 home runs, 45 RBIs, playing for manager Pat Borders. Not everyone knew he was draft eligible, did they?
No, not a lot of people knew, because he was a year behind in school, but his class was graduating. I think it was ourselves, the Dodgers and Blue Jays, is what the kid told me, the team that talked to him. And what attracted, well, you know, he lived 20 minutes from my house. He, when he was like 9, 10 years old, he came to my little winter camps, my little hitting sessions mm-hmm. that I had. And then he ended up going to a sports program in Boucherville, the Demartine program. Basically, as I watched him, you know, grow a little bit and watched him play major AAA, and the last time I'd really seen him as a tournament 12 in Toronto, simple, it was his bat. The sound was just completely different. When he took BP or he took a swing, it was like, it was a natural swing, and the ball was hit hard. And Pat Borders, who, you know, was his manager this year, and a lot of the reports, and anytime he talked to a reporter, like, Peltier's sound is different than anybody else's. So basically, it's the bat. And what we did with Ben, we knew that was, well, we brought him to Philly for the pre-draft. At that time, he was, that was June, because he's, I think, a September, October birthday. He was 16 years old. And he's in Citizens Bank Park. We're in the pre-draft workout. Basically, you get 8 to 10 swings, and he hit a couple out. He's 16 years old. It's a wood bat.
Wow.
He's a strong, physical kid, very, you know, very natural strength. So we go into the meetings up there, and at that point, it's Ruben Amaro, who's the GM, and Marty Wohler. We're watching video of T-12, and they were looking at him, and Amaro's like, wow, this kid is eligible. And if he'd be a Dominican kid, you know, he'd be 16 in July, we could, you know, sign this kid and send him out. This kid's, you know, he's worth something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Ben, since he had driven 8.5 hours, I asked him to stick around. So what we did is we went down to cages, because the Phillies had a night game that night. And he went down there, and Darren Ruff and Ryan Howard are out there taking some swings, like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I asked the hitting coach, hey, could this kid just, you know, hang out with you guys for now? He goes, sure, get out of here, you Alex, and we'll work with him. So he worked there for an hour, and we went back up there in the pre-draft meetings and told Ben, okay, you know, you'll be in the draft board, and we'll see how it goes. And I guess that, you know, they had an agent at that point. They had put out, you know, some big numbers, and I guess that might have scared off some teams. We took him late.
Mm-hmm.
It was the family trusted me. We ended up coming to a deal that made everybody happy, and we signed him to a year after deal, because he had a year of high school left. It was very important for his parents, for him to, like, not graduate high school. So we let him, didn't even bring him to instructionally. He just went down to Florida for like 2 weeks as a guest player, didn't play in any games, worked out, got to meet the coaches. Went home in September, finished his school, did his graduation, came down in late June, and then got his feet wet, you know, in about 100 at-bats with the Gulf Coast League. I think that was in 2016. You know, he held his own. I think he hit like only 225, but still, he got his baptism, and he was still only 17 and a half years old. And then in 17, he just, you know, had a great year, hitting 333, an all-star. And this year was another great year where he's just going to have to hit. You know, he's not going to steal you 50 bases and maybe win gold gloves in left field or right field, but he makes the plays. His arm is solid. And now he's 20 years old, and he's turning into a man physically. And he knows that, you know, he's never going to be the high-profile first-round pick who got $5 million, but if he keeps being hitting third and fourth in the lineup every day, and he'll only be 21 next year at the end of the year, well, you know, there's a chance for this guy to be a productive, you know, power-hitting corner outfielder if we go from there. So his makeup, too, is something that I knew that he was very even-keeled, not a very rah-rah guy, and he's just going to keep getting stronger. And we've surrounded him real well. You know, the Phillies have done a great job in his development. And back home here, my partner in my baseball camps, the baseball empire, Ivan Nakarada, who works out and is Russell Martin's personal manager, has taken this kid under his wing and work with him in the wintertime, help him out, talk baseball. Because when you're sitting home in Varennes, Quebec, there's not a lot of people you can talk baseball about. So that was a fun one because at that time, Amaro had seen him in the pre-draft, if I'm not mistaken, and that was Johnny Almaraz, not Marty Wolliver, sorry. It was Johnny Almaraz's first draft as a scouting director of the Phillies, and he loved the kid's bat. And he told me, we'll sign him to a deal after that. And so, you know, that worked out pretty good for the kid now. Mm-hmm. Again, it's still a long way from the big leagues, but at least he knows he's on the right track.
Yeah, and how patient do you guys have to be with players like this? Obviously, you get him at a young age. He struggles a little bit early on, which makes sense. They obviously have to go through growing pains, but of course, you guys do your due diligence on every player that you pick. With these young guys, how patient do you guys have to be until you say, all right, maybe, I mean, not you made a mistake, but maybe we need to move in a different direction?
Well, I think you got to give the kid at least 3 years. I mean, you know,
3 years?
Last year in the New York Penn League was his third year. If you think about it, we sign the players out of the Dominican, and they go to our academy down there for 2 years, and then some of those guys come to 2 years to the Gulf Coast League. So they've played 4 years and haven't gotten out of rookie ball, and some of those kids explode in their fifth year. Phillies have been very patient with high school players. I mean, I've signed every one of my guys in the system right now, all high school kids, and they're all still hanging around because the team's impatient. Their development, you know, is slow but sure. So you got to give those kids hopefully at least 3 years, unless the kid really can't do anything and you really, you know, you cut your losses. But I mean, some of these kids, they haven't signed for $1 million. So it's like, even if you sign a kid and he doesn't get out of A ball, you know, you've given him, you know, 50, 100, 150. I mean, it's
right.
It's peanuts compared to guys who don't get out of the A ball and who give him $2 million. So that'll happen to all teams and to all scouts. But I think the Phillies development system over the last few years have been very patient, have been very good. They love their players. First rounder, 40th rounder, they treat them equally. And that's coming from the players themselves. You know, sometimes they're told, don't sign, you're a 30th rounder. They won't care. Well, the player comes back at the end of the year and says, oh, man, they treated me like the first rounder. They took as much time with him, as much time with me, and did it like that. So, you know, Calcio knows that he'll have BP, he'll have his work, gone to instructional league the last few years, and you just got to be a bit more patient with the high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that we have a big, you know, influence in the Dominican Republic. We had a lot of Latin players down there, and it pays off. You look at our big league pitcher, Sir Anthony Dominguez. I mean, he was just okay in his first few years in the Dominican Summer League and our Gulf Coast League. And, you know, the guy explodes in his fifth or sixth year. Now you've got yourself a big leaguer who's throwing 95 to 100. And the guy signed for, I don't know, but not too much, maybe $50,000. And he's up there in the big leagues. But that was because our system was patient enough to let him develop into a man. Now you're drafting a college guy who's 21 or 22 now. You know, your patience might be a little, you know, quicker. Like after the second or third year, he's 24 years old. Now you're like, what do you got? You got an organizational guy? Do you got a prospect, or do you got a non-prospect? So
other. And, you know, the ones who succeed keep going. The other ones go and get a real job like most of the people in life.
Right. And Alex, I want to kind of fast forward to the present, to where we are now going through the winter. I mean, is there any off season for a scout? What's the day in the life for you like now and during the season?
Well, the game has changed a lot. There's not a lot of off season. There's meetings. There's, you know, there's fall showcases. There's scout days. And I, you know, I cover seven states and half of Canada. So basically the fall is you do a lot of college scout days where you go and, you know, the colleges organize a day where you can, you go meet with the players, watch a practice, and they do you, they do like a tryout. You know, they run the 60, and they do an infield, outfield. They take BP, pitchers throw the bullpens, and you get to do all your stuff. Then you got all the high school showcases from Tournament 12 in Canada to Jupiter to all sorts of things. But at this time of the year, basically, let's say from December 15th to about January 10th, it gets to be quiet, where all you're doing is phone calls and doing home visits with players. But in my case, like next week, tomorrow, Monday, it's on the road and meeting some players, and our first pre-draft meetings are January 9th and 10th already in Philly to talk about our top players, because like you were asking, there's not really much of an off-season. You're already working, you know, 2018 draft is over. You already got a list of 2019 and 2020, and June 10th, you're already gone to an event that's players for 2019 draft. So basically, there's a lot of travel in the summer with the showcases and, you know, in my case, covering the Cape League, couple of teams, going to All-Stars and events. The fall is all about, you know, colleges and high school showcases. And the winter, as next Monday rolls around, it's basically starting to go watch kids work out and to meet and do what we call the home visits, the signability process as you keep going and turn the corner. And February 14th is around there, and the NCAA season starts. So your teams, like my top teams, like University of Connecticut, they're down in Florida playing against Louisville. St. John's University is going to be down in California. Boston College, you know, is in North Carolina. So you have to organize your schedule and your territory to make sure you get to see those colleges early. And then when high school baseball comes in, like at the middle of March, you got to be ready to go see your top players early. So a lot of your work is done before the season started. Now it's to go watch the players play and compete and see if they're healthy and see if the tools you saw in the past are better. And you got to make sure the player wants to be a professional player. And the signability is more and more important every year as we move along this time. But, you know, you do take some time off end of December, early January, but you're still watching. You're still on the Internet, you know, looking at reports, looking at videos, talking to players, meeting with players, talking to college coaches. And getting ready for the season. Once the season starts, like early February, then it's a whirlwind for 4 months before the draft. And then after the draft, it's assignments. You know, okay, you got to cover the Cape. You got to go to Atlanta for this tournament. You got to go to the Perfect Game event while trying to watch some of your summer collegiate leagues. Because in New England, you know, I got the Cape League, a couple of teams, but you got the New England Collegiate League. You got the Futures League. You got the New York Collegiate League. There's baseball, like non-stop.
Yeah. It seems like obviously a busy offseason, a lot of places to travel, a lot of new talent to see. But you talked about this a little bit before. Obviously, there's been a shift in technology that you can use as a scout. With the era of advanced statistics, as we were talking about technology to measure swing rate, there's power, speed, swing plane, anything you can really name. Has that in any way kind of influenced you as a scout?
Well, extra tools, it's extra knowledge. We have a tremendous staff up in Philadelphia that if we need anything, we can get what we call stat players. If we need information or extra stats on a college player specifically, I can ask and get it.
Yeah.
And I like to get a list at the start of the year, which our guys do, I mean, tremendous work in the office where, here, Alex, in your area, here are the players who statistically, you know, let's stay away from the exit velo and launch angles and all that, because that's other things. You have to have the player tested yourself,
right,
or some of the top colleges have that, or in the Cape. But, you know, somebody who's had a great year, like just in New England, I got 37 Division I schools between New York and New England, and there's a lot of D2 schools. There's a lot of baseball in New England. And if you get to maybe some of the top players whose stats college-wise, you know, are equal to some guys who are in the big leagues, and you might not know them, but you might say, you know what, you call this coach because you know him, you've got this player, what do you think about his tool? Go see him. So it just gives you extra knowledge.
Right.
You're going to miss plays. You can't be everywhere. There's just so many days in a week, so many months before the draft. But the more information you have, it helps you to decide where you might want to go on a quiet day. You know, which player in this Division II school who's had some success having players drafted is the best. Does his stats, you know, rack up against another player who was drafted before, who's made in the big leagues, who's played in a similar type of conference? And now the other stuff you get, you know, at the big showcases where you get exit velos, where you get launch angles, that's just more stuff to help you when you get to your draft to have more information. But you still have to scout the player, especially the younger they are. You still need to, you know, the guy might have tremendous perfect launch angle and perfect bat speed in BP, but he swings and misses 4 to 5 times in games. And that's something that's tough to change, you know. Mm-hmm. Russell Martin, we didn't have all that knowledge back then, but Russell Martin never swung and missed when I saw him play. The 15-year-old, the 16-year-old, the 17-year-old, and even in the big leagues, early on in his career, great walk rate. Even in his, like, last year where he hit only 200, he still got on base. You know, and those are things that have followed him. You know, maybe his swinging rate is not as good as it used to be with guys throwing 100 miles an hour now, but the years that he had his best years with him, same thing I saw at 15, 16. So it's nice to have that information and that knowledge and the extra info. You still got to watch a player compete.
Yeah.
Because the game is played between the white lines. It's not played on a computer. So, you know, once they get to the next level, those players are given more info and they're shown, you know, more analytics to help them become the better ones. You still have to bring in a kid who has the tools to play and compete, who can swing it against 97, mm-hmm. who can barrel the ball, who's got barrel awareness, and that can't be taught by an analytics department. But I think if you merge both together, you can really, you know, have a great outcome.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, what you said exactly, the game is played in between the white lines. It's not played on a computer. I really like that. And for kids who kind of grow up with all this extra noise now, as I said before, with all the things that you can measure, what advice would you give to ball players listening to this, kind of trying to climb the ladder, trying to get to college, or trying to get drafted?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, first of all, love the game.
Yeah.
Play with passion and work harder than anybody else on your team, because, I mean, there's no reason to lack work ethic. You know, there might be a reason that you're 5'9 and the other guy's 6'2 and throws 94 and you throw 88. That could be genetic, but there's no reason that guy can't outwork the other guy, or hitting-wise, the same thing. And try not to listen to all the banter around all the different websites where this guy, you know, I hit a ball, his exit velo was 97 and yours is 94. Well, you know what? I want to watch the game. Mm-hmm. And the guy whose exit velo might be 94, he's 2-for-4 with the guys on scoring position. The other guy's 0-for-4 when it counts. So that's where you have to really do your work and not just believe it. Because sometimes the players, and especially the parents or, you know, the guys running these things are so into just the numbers and they forget that there's a game to be played. That's why I said before, merge both. That you gotta, you know, you have to have bat speed in the big leagues. You have to have strength. You know, you have to have all these little different things. But the more I talk to ex-big leaguers or current big leaguers about stuff, it's like, you know, it's hard to hit a slider that's 94 miles an hour if they pitch it at the right spot. So do not listen to everybody, but work as hard as you can. And if you have the talent and the tools and the proper makeup, you're going to be seen and taken care of. But you still, this is a game that you have to compete. The higher the player's compete level is, the more I want to have that kid in my system, because those things there are tough to teach. The other things, you know, you can work in the gym as you get older. You can do some different things. You can learn, you know, a different bat path. You can learn on what you're trying to do and stuff like that. But you need to enjoy the game, play it with passion, and don't let the other things bother you. You know, you're ranked 18th and your buddy's ranked 95th, and it doesn't matter. You go into people's homes sometimes, and they're like, oh, my God, how come this guy's ranked higher than me? I go, who cares? I'm in your home right now. I like what Baseball America ranks you compared to the other. All you should care is that it takes one team to like you better than another team, and you draft a player that may be ranked, that may not be ranked. So that's why that's what the scout is paid for his opinion. So, I mean, all these young players, keep going to the showcases, no problem, keep doing it, but if you're good and you have the tools and the proper attitude, you'll be seen. And for players in Canada, I mean, they're pretty lucky. I mean, there's a great program, the Canadian national team run by Greg Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
The players that are there, the scouts scout them heavily. They get to be seen. The Tournament 12 is an outstanding event where you get kids from all across Canada, a lot of kids who don't even make the national team but get seen by colleges. I might like a player that didn't make the national team because he might not be ready to compete for them, but I might like him in 4 years, you know?
Right.
We drafted Ben Peltier like, before the national team could even get to him. You know, and I'm doing my job. Greg Hamilton's doing his job, which he does tremendously. But at the same time, these players have so many events to be seen. And these Canadians, they don't have to travel to, like, 19 of them. You know, you get T12, you get the Canada Cup, you get Team Canada if you make it. It's a great thing. And don't be in a rush. You know, if you're not drafted out of high school, go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Show your stuff. You know, keep developing as you keep going. Because baseball, you can draft kids from, you know, Quebec at 17, but the rest of the world, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. It's a long-term development sport. So, I mean, if you love the game and they put a uniform on your back and you have a spot in the lineup, keep playing as long as you can.
Awesome, Alex. Thanks again for coming on, and thank you for your knowledge and sharing your journey. But before I let you go, obviously Canadians are increasingly putting their mark on the game, contributing at the big league level. You saw it this year with your Phillies. Obviously, there's Nick Pivetta, Mike Soroka on Atlanta. We saw Tyler O'Neill in St. Louis this year as well. There are a lot more coming down the chute. In your eyes, how has the game developed and evolved over the years north of the border, and kind of what is the current state?
Well, it's developed tremendously. From when I coached in 94, where we got the team together after a tournament for 2 weeks and flew to Toronto and then flew to Brandon, Manitoba for a tournament, the players are more knowledgeable, they're more exposed, they're better trained. You know, you were talking about all those Canadians. There's another one who you got to the big leagues in 2017 with the Phillies, Justin Therrien, who's now a Dodger. I mean, those are players that drafted in the 17th round have an opportunity to make the big leagues. That's what I love about Canada. And what the industry likes about it is, like, these players are tough. These players are, you talked about Soroka, you talked about O'Neill. These guys are, they don't give up. They don't quit. Mm-hmm. They have talent, but they also have grit. But the game has changed where the players are more advanced. The players are training, you know, when they're younger. Everybody's throwing harder. So then there's more competition involved. Every team is now watching what's going on in Canada. Back then, it was the Blue Jays, the Expos, and maybe a couple of teams that had a couple of scouts, you know, like the Mariners with Wayne Norton and the Dodgers and Mets with Claude Peltier. Most other teams were just, now it's every team is involved. So, you know, the players have a lot more opportunity to be seen than in the past, be it the national team, be it collegiately or professionally. And, you know, there's just tremendous advancement in technology that makes the players just more physical. These players, there's no time off. You were asking about the time off for scouts. There's none, but these players now train 12 months a year. There's always somebody throwing harder. There's always somebody hitting the ball further. There's always somebody trying to make you better. And I think the game's in a great place. You hope that the players, you know, keep moving the game forward and that, you know, the Expos come back one day.
Yeah, I think there's millions of people who want that as well. Alex, and kind of as an aside, do you think Canadian players kind of, at times, have an unrealistic approach when it comes to signing bonuses?
It's a great question. I mean, the Canadian players, the first fold is the Canadian players have a great reputation as great people, which I love. You know, every time I say, you know, I'm Canadian, I'm from Montreal, there's a respect factor. There are players who come from here. I do think over the years, what's happened is the players, since they're so much more showcased and there's so much more attention put on them, and they've had players who signed, like the Naylor brothers, you know, Garrett Morgan, Soroka, and others who signed great contracts. And it's great for those kids because it was all deserving. Every one of those kids who got good bonuses because they were deserving of that. What happens is sometimes the players, you know, put themselves, they compare themselves from one draft to another. Well, if this guy got this, I'm worth this. Well, it's a new draft. It's a new team. And there's other players across this beautiful world of baseball that play baseball also. It's not just us. So sometimes the players, it's unrealistic, but myself as a scout, I want to make sure that the player wants to play. Let's take the money aside. And then the money takes care of itself. If you're a first rounder, this is what it is. If it's a second rounder, this is what it is. What does it take for you to be happy? And sometimes it's either the parents or the agents that make it where, you know, this player here is going to go to school, and you know what? I don't want to force you to play professional baseball. I want you to force me to like you. And then the money will take care of itself. And sometimes I think what we've had in the last few years, the Canadians, the big guys have signed, and all the other players have just, you know, slightly moved on. But that's the scout's job to find out. Like, I knew that Ben Peltier was going to sign, not no matter what, and we treated him fairly.
Yeah.
I mean, his path to a major league career was not through college. You know, maybe for a kid in Ontario or Alberta or BC, it's different. But there's other kids who sign still, and it's our job to find the ones who want to play that have the ability. And the ones who want to go to college, I'm all for it. You know, it's just that sometimes you, as a scout, you feel, am I wasting my time? I love this kid. I'm following in. The kid wants to play. And then, you know, a week before the draft, the number that comes out is just out of this world. And you're like, wow, well, you know, good luck. I hope you get it. But if you don't, I'll still call you maybe on day three of the draft to offer you something lower, and don't kill the messenger, you know. And yeah. If it's done with respect, and, you know, most of the agents do it with respect, it's okay. But I think the players are more aware. And it's not like, hey, the Expos or the Blue Jays come calling, I'll sign for anything. Those days are over. Mm-hmm.
Well, Alex, honestly, thank you for coming on the show. Congrats on the award again. This is kind of new on the Canadian Baseball Network podcast. We've had players, coaches, managers, managing directors, people who have influenced the game in numerous different ways. But again, thank you for coming on and giving us a different look into a different side of baseball.
Well, I appreciate it, Dustin. It was my pleasure, and a happy new year to all the listeners in 2019, and a great baseball season to all Canadian baseball.